You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. Senator Cray Deeds and Delegate David Toscano provided their perspectives on issues that came before the 2014 legislature. Deeds and Toscano spoke at the Wednesday, May 14, 2014 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV President Bob McGrath.
For the annual report, we invite all of our elected representatives whose districts include Charlottesville or parts of Albemarle County to come and talk to us. Today, we're very pleased that Senator Cray Deeds and Delegate David Toscano found the time in their busy schedules to be here. Unfortunately, our other elected representatives couldn't be here because of scheduling conflicts. That's too bad, but on the other hand, we have with us two of the most important legislators in the Commonwealth. Now, I do want to say that we are pleased that Judy Wyatt, who is the Chief of Staff for Delegate Landis, is here with us in the audience, and she may weigh in later on in the questions and answers if she sees fit. Senator Deeds represents the 25th Senate District, which includes all or parts of the counties of Allegheny, Albemarle, Bath, Highland, Nelson, and Rockbridge, and the cities of Buena Vista, Charlottesville, Covington, and Lexington. He was elected to the House of Delegates in 1991, winning re-election five times before filling the seat of the late Senator Emily Couric in a special election in 2001. He's been the Democratic nominee for State Attorney General in 2005 and for Governor in 2009. In the Senate, he serves as Chair of the Transportation Committee, and he's on the Finance, General Laws and Technology, Privileges and Elections, and the Rules Committees. Senator Deeds has degrees from Concord College and from Wake Forest Law School, and he has a law practice has had a law practice in Hot Springs since 1984. Since the senator's family tragedy last year, he's committed himself to making Virginia have effective procedures for handling mental health emergencies. He's characterized a new law, which was signed earlier this year, in fact, just a few weeks ago, as at least a first step along this path. Delegate Toscano represents the 57th District, Charlottesville, and part of Albemarle County. He was first elected to the House in 2006. Since 2011, he has been House Minority Leader. He serves on the Justice, Transportation, and Science and Technology Committees of the House. Before going to the House of Delegates, Delegate Toscano served for a number of years on the Charlottesville City Council, and for some of those years as mayor of the city. He has a BA from Colgate, a PhD from Boston College, and a UVA law degree. He practices law here in Charlottesville. Now, gentlemen, please talk to us about anything you like having to do with the 2014 legislative session. I want to remind the audience there's plenty of time for questions and answers afterward, but if you have a question, the drill is that you have to wait for one of us to hand you a microphone so you can speak into it, because, as you know, all of these programs are podcasted later. So, Senator, would you like to begin?
It's an honor to be here. It's an honor to represent you in the state Senate. Now, since we have all afternoon, David and I are going to filibuster and do a whole lot of talking. And Judy actually is going to carry most of the weight. She's actually going to do most of the talking. Let me just say, David and I are here because we represent you. I represent everybody here, practically, unless you live out in Keswick. And David represents most of you that live here. But service in the legislature, while it's an incredible honor and a full-time responsibility, it's only a part-time job. You know, we have to work for a living. And honestly, there are things that I don't get to because I've got to be in court or I've got other responsibilities. And if I'm going to pay my bills and keep my creditors happy and my family fed, I've got to work, and other legislators do too. So take that for what it is. Other people aren't here. Some of them can't be here. I want to talk a little bit about the legislative session, it goes on, and we're still in session technically. The regular session ended the second Saturday of March, I guess, and we came home. We bounced back and forth a couple of times, and we still have the significant work of the session to accomplish, and that's get a budget passed. Virginia's, but you know, our sessions, you know, are 60 days in long years, 46 days in short years. So we're never in, the legislature is never in session very long, but we're required each year to get a budget passed. And the budget's a two-year spending plan. This is the first year of the budget. And so if we don't have a plan in place by July 1, we will be in absolutely uncharted water. We've always had a budget plan in place. I'm confident we will this time. How we get there still isn't real clear. But I'll talk about that in a minute. A whole lot of what gets accomplished in Richmond in the General Assembly session, I've been there for 23 sessions, and I've seen the process become, it used to be very, you know, I'm wandering, I apologize, but as Virginians, we can be really proud of what happened, the legislative process. It happened here first, 1619. The legislative process in the Western Hemisphere, what happens in the other 49 states and what sometimes happens and doesn't happen in Washington is modeled after what happened here first. The whole model was a citizen legislature made up of people who don't make their livings off of government, who have to make a living under the laws and amongst the people that are subject to the laws. And the process, while it's confounding sometimes, it still works, I would suggest, best here in Virginia. You know, and sometimes we have problems. The last 23 years, the process has become more partisan. It's become more like Washington. It's less everybody work together to get things done, and more my side, your side. You know, that part of it is very troubling. But a whole lot of what happens when we work together. You know, mental health this year, you know, nobody ever said we were going to fix everything in one fell swoop. What we did was we addressed the front-end crisis intervention piece. We ensured, working together, delegates and senators, Democrats and Republicans, we ensured that a person who's in a crisis, has been determined to be a danger to himself or others, will be in a bed. That person will not be on the street again. And that only occurs in about 3% of the cases in Virginia. But we closed that loophole with the legislation that passed this year, and that's what we intended to do. But because we know that's not the end all, we know there's a whole lot to do. Too many people live crisis to crisis. We don't have answers for long-term care for the mentally ill. We created a four-year legislative study. And we're going to work together over the next 4 years to craft answers, hopefully. And my goal is that we, at the end of the day, we have a system of mental health care in Virginia that's a model for the other 49 states, because I truly don't believe that we are in this crisis by ourselves. I think that whatever problems are exist in a lot of other states. There may be models in other states, though, that we can look at. There may be programs that work in some areas, and I know that there are. And we're going to be doing that over the next 4 years. The second big thing I think we accomplished this time, and this goes back to the mid-90s when we adopted the standards of learning in Virginia. There were some of us who were serving then who argued that the standards of learning were going to, as proposed, were going to be disruptive. We're going to be costly. We're going to put too much much focus on rote memorization and less focus on creativity in the classroom and the development of problem solving. And to a large extent, we've been proven true. That's been proven true. There's some success stories, and we're not arguing that excellence shouldn't take place, and we ought to have some objective means to test for it. But what we did this year, Democrats and Republicans, delegates and senators working together, we crafted legislation to reduce the number of SOL tests, primarily for third through fifth graders, where children really ought to be focused on learning the basics, reading, writing, arithmetic. I mean, But all the way through high school, we've reduced the number of SOL tests. We set up an accountability, an education accountability council that's made primarily, it's got some legislative input, but it's made governed by the Secretary of Education, the Superintendent of Public Instruction, but it's made up primarily of parents and teachers, people who are professionals in the field of education, to figure out how we replace the SOLs, what we do next to make sure that what remains of the SOLs are implemented in a way that works for all of our kids. So those are the two big things I think we accomplished this year, mental health reform and SOL reform. The hang-up is over the budget, and that's frankly over Medicaid expansion. That's not any big surprise. However you frame the issue, whatever names you put to it, the problem is that too many people in Virginia don't have health insurance. They go to emergency rooms for their primary care. When they go for primary care, it's too late in many cases. They're near the end of life. There's no preventative medicine. The end-of-life care is the most expensive. The rest of us who have insurance subsidized already, because our insurance rates go up. The hospitals have to eat the cost. The insurance companies have to eat the cost. So the Affordable Care Act, it's one of the most controversial things in recent American history, one of the most divisive things that I can think of in my lifetime. But it's the law. It's the law. And the Affordable Care Act has Medicaid expansion. That's the piece the Supreme Court, when they upheld the Affordable Care Act, said that the states could decide themselves whether to implement Medicaid expansion. So people, there are up to 400,000 people in Virginia that would qualify for Medicaid expansion. Now, here's the thing about the Affordable Care Act. It is the law. Your taxes, if you make enough money, your taxes and fees have already gone up to pay for it. Virginia is paying for it already. The question is, do we bring any of those dollars back? There have been some analysis that suggests that we could create, through Medicaid expansion, up to 30,000 jobs primarily in the healthcare field over the next 6 years. Medicaid expansion to Virginia means about $5 million a day in federal funding. The way we've written the law is, we've already given up about $600 million because we didn't implement Medicaid expansion the first of the year. The way we've written it, if the federal government, feds fail to fund at least 90% of the cost of expansion, we're going to drop out of it. Right now, the way they have it set up, they pay 100% the first 3 years. They pay between 97 down to 90% for the 3 years that follows that. And the way our legislation that's already been approved by the Secretary of Health at the federal level says we drop out if they fail to fund 90%. So from my perspective, the worst that can happen is that we get federal funding for up to 6 years, and then they drop below 90%, and people lose their insurance. That's a tragic event, but that's a chance I'm willing to take. The best that can happen is that we insure up to 400,000 people from here on. We improve the health of Virginia's working poor, because that's primarily who you're talking about. 70% of the people, these 400,000 people, 70% of the people either work or they live in the household with somebody who works. So you're primarily talking about people who are making minimum wage or close to minimum wage and not getting benefits through their employer. The worst that can happen is that we insure these people for 6 years and then it ends. But it's being hung up now, and the argument is that and David can talk about this because he's in the House of Delegates, where the real argument is. In the Senate, we have bipartisan agreement to move forward. We've taken a different approach than straight-out Medicaid expansion. It's called Marketplace Virginia. It basically puts it over. It involves the private sector, insurance sector, and the provision of coverage. But it still allows us to recapture about $2.1 billion a year that we're already paying and insure, and provides coverage up to 400,000 people. That's the hang-up. That's where we are. No resolution's in sight, but June 30 is in sight, and that's when we drop dead. That's when we have to have a budget in place. And I'm confident we'll get it done. I don't know what the path is right now, but I'm confident we'll get it done. David?
My turn. I can't see you all back there, so. Sorry, Jim.
You can stand here if you want.
Oh, this is much nicer. I feel like I'm singing. It's great to be here again. I think I've been here every year since I've been in the General Assembly, which I started coming here back in 2006. In 2006, you remember, I know you remember every session. 2006, we went up to June 30th before we got a budget. And for many, and part of that debate was about transportation. And in fact, last year at this time, we were talking about what had happened in the session, and we were celebrating the historic bipartisan transportation bill after we had discussed it for so many years in here. And how many times did I say to people, when you go to the gas pump and you pump your gas and you pay those federal tax dollars and they're flowing to Washington, unless we put dollars on the table in Virginia, we don't get those tax dollars back. Well, doesn't that sound familiar? And we decided last year they were going to do the transportation bill in order to help us get some of this federal dollars back. Now we're finding the feds are having a hard time funding their transportation bill. So maybe we need to send some Republicans and Democrats up to D.C. and maybe help them out a little bit. A few just comments about some of our colleagues who aren't here today, Steve Landis and Rob Bell. We are a citizen legislature. We have to work for a living. Three of the four of us are lawyers, Rob, Cree, and myself. Steve has a harder time sometimes because he works for a real business, you know, which has real hours. And so sometimes he has a hard time getting over here. But if you have any questions, the person to ask is Judy. I mean, she knows more. And she knows what's behind every closet door, too, because she's been down in Richmond a long time. She's been a great help. I was joking to her, should I play Steve Landis for the day? And she said, well, I love you, David, but I'm not sure you should try to do that. On the other hand, Rob Bell and I kind of joke all the time about how we've been on so many forums together. We can play each other. So I suffice it to say that my friend Steve and my friend Rob, I don't always agree on with, but it's good to have him where you can have the debate. Steve is a good person to know because he's on appropriations, and anybody's on appropriations is a good person to know. Rob, for all the things I disagree with him on, Rob has been very instrumental in helping us get some of this mental health legislation passed. After the Virginia Tech tragedy, we had a number of bills that got through the House Courts of Justice Committee, and Rob and I worked on those together. And then this year, we had some pretty substantial changes in mental health legislation that he worked on. So enough for my kind comments. I'll be savaging them later on in the discussion when we talk about Medicaid expansion. Cree mentioned, we had a few victories in the session. One was SOL reform, which I think was substantial, the mental health reforms that we enacted. And there was a little bit of a budget reform bill that got passed in the aftermath of the scandal involving Governor McDonnell. It wasn't as tight as I would have liked it, but it was something that was better than we had previously. And, my view about ethics in government is, you got to elect good people who are going to do ethical things. You can't really legislate ethics. You can toughen some of the rules and make it easier for people to comply with them. But ultimately, it comes down to the person who's sitting in the chair. I like to think that most of the folks in the General Assembly, even though I might disagree with them politically, are pretty good on the ethical front. You don't see too much stuff, but there was enough going on with Governor McDonnell, I think, that we had to make some changes. In terms of where we are right now, I think Senator Deeds put it quite well. You know, we're in this position now where the Senate has refused to take up the House budget and the House has refused to take up the Senate budget. Until that happens, we don't even have a budget to talk about in conference. Last time we were down there, the Senate passed a budget, sent it over to the House. And the House said, no, we're just not going to take it up. We don't want it. We're not going to put it in conference. That's what you got to do when you have a difference of opinion on the budgets. You got to put them into conference so you can have a discussion about it. We're not even there. So it's hard to predict what's going to happen on June 30th, at least right now. I mean, some of us can see a sweet spot where you might be able to do some things, but the politics of it are really quite depressing right now. For those of you who want, how many people here are on my email list? Anybody? So you get some of the stuff I put out. I don't know if you all read it, but you do get it. So here's your other opportunity to read it. Anybody, I'll pass this around. Anybody who wants to read a perspective on Medicaid expansion and why there might be some common ground can read this. But I think so much of it has to do with the politics on the ground. To be perfectly blunt, the Republicans in the House are scared to death of being primaried by folks who are very conservative from the Tea Party ilk, who, if a Republican votes for anything that smacks of supporting Barack Obama, they're going to get primaried. And if you saw what happened this last week to Eric Cantor and the person he wanted to win the 7th District Republican chairmanship, that would also scare you. So that didn't help matters at all. You know, sometimes things that are happening in other arenas have an impact on what will happen in the General Assembly. That was one, because Eric Cantor is a pretty powerful guy. And the fact that his guy for chair in the 7th District was defeated puts a scare into a lot of people. Be that as it may, in the end, I believe that most of my colleagues have to realize that you can't kick away $5.2 million a day. You got to figure out a way to get that money back. If you call it Marketplace Virginia, fine. You call it a pilot, fine. You call it a block grant, fine. I don't care what you call it. That's our money. And it doesn't make a lot of sense to me that we should be sending it to D.C. where it's either going to get stuck somewhere in a basement or it's going out to Connecticut or some other state that's doing Medicaid expansion. I'd like to think the business argument is pretty darn compelling. We can talk a little bit later about the impacts on UVA. Anybody who represents this area has got to recognize that we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars at stake for UVA. And the hospitals all over the Commonwealth are going to lose a lot of money if Medicaid expansion is not done in some form. So in conclusion of my opening remarks, it's great to be here today. You guys always ask such wonderful questions, put us on the hot seat. We'll make sure that Steve and Rob know that we're on the hot seat, and we'll pass on the questions that you asked of us to them so they can feel the hot seat. Thank you.
Thanks, gentlemen. Should have two microphones. John is back there with one. Jeff is about to get another microphone. Here's the first questioner right over here.
Our governor, Mr. McAuliffe, has contemplated handling this Medicaid expansion by an executive order. And I'm just wondering how I should feel about that. Is that kind of over the top? Is that a stretch of our system of checks and balances in this country? Should we be operating on that way, or is that a no-no? Will it do more damage to the system than it?
That's a perfectly good question. You know, from my perspective, you know, in Kentucky, that's the way it happened. In other states, it's happened that way. Is that the way we want it to happen in Virginia? I think that the legislature needs to be heard on this. I think that the legislature, you know, I'm concerned about the precedent of having the governor do it by executive order. On the other hand, I think there probably is a path for him to do that. if it's going to take, and I think this is such an important issue for Virginia. If he can find that path, if he's got smarter lawyers working for him than me, if they can find that path, I'm going to support him. I hope it doesn't come to that. I hope we can move together through the legislative process. I am concerned about the precedent.
I'm concerned too. Governor McAuliffe has made it very clear that this is a number one priority for him, and he's going to try to do it any way he can. He's made it very clear that he wants a legislative solution. I think most people recognize that they also are looking for other options too. I don't know how that stands up legally. I mean, you got to look at the Constitution and what you can do and what you can't do. You have to look at precedent and whether this would serve a bad precedent for the future. There are a whole lot of very difficult questions on how you do this. I still am optimistic that at the end of the day, that the legislature is going to figure out a way to do this. And maybe it won't take the form of them actually voting it up or down. Maybe there will be a way that we can see a path where we can set some parameters in place that if you check the box and you do this or you do this or certain reforms are in place, then it comes automatically. That way they don't have to vote for it, because I think they're worried about voting for it. So we got to figure out a way to help them not have to vote for it, and yet we can get it.
Kentucky with a Democratic governor and Ohio with a Republican governor. But I mean, it's worth examining whether the structure of those governments, whether their governments are so different than ours that the precedent applies. And I just don't know enough about Kentucky or Ohio.
And there's one other comment on that. It was last year, I think, as part of the budget, everybody says you can't really talk about Medicaid in the budget. But as part of the budget, we passed a new statute, and that was to create the Medicaid Innovation and Reform Commission. And Delegate Landis sits on he's the vice chair. So if you've got any concerns about Medicaid, you talk to Judy, because she needs to know that.
We've been getting plenty of concerns.
Okay. So, and in the Medicaid Innovation and Reform Commission, it was contemplated if you did certain reforms, the Medicaid Innovation Reform Commission could vote by a majority in each house to go ahead and expand. So that is a way that the legislature wouldn't actually have to take a vote. The problem is that people in the Medicaid Innovation Reform Commission keep saying that the reforms are not enough, and so therefore we're not going to vote for it. So one way you can influence the process is contact those people and tell them you think the reforms are enough, which, by the way, it booked some $200 million in savings just in this year based on the reforms that have been done in the last year. So it's important to know that we are working on reform, and people continue to be willing to work on reform.
Hi. Thank you both for being here. You are, with that question, from a personal standpoint, my two favorite legislators in the state of Virginia. And it's a slightly tongue-in-cheek, but it's also a little serious. And I have a suggestion for you. How about the next time everybody gets together, you guys bring a sandbox to Richmond, and with a sign, it's time to play in the sandbox.
Good idea. There's a big statue of Washington, a very important statue, right in the middle between the two houses. Maybe we could take the statue down and put the sandbox in. Would that work?
Maybe I should know this, but you both mentioned June 30th. But when do you actually go back to discuss it?
Well, June 30th is the end of the fiscal year. There's right now no meeting scheduled for us to go back. Right now we're just kind of, one side won't take up the other's bill. The other side won't take the other's bill. I mean, everybody's just kind of standing up and say, now it's my football. Oh. We're either going to play by my rules or we're going to go home. Both sides are playing that way. And nobody's got the football. The people of Virginia have the football. And we're, the people of Virginia are the ones that are going to fall through the cracks if we don't, if somebody doesn't agree to work together.
Maybe we could put pressure on some of our legislators. Not you, of course.
Or give us the football.
I thought maybe I'd go to a different topic. The Daily Progress printed the districts and what who represents what. And the third district, which is Richmond, has an arm so that it goes into to Petersburg. But it has also three or four districts which are not even connected to the third district down in Norfolk.
Right.
And this is the damnedest thing I've ever seen. When does this come up, the redistricting?
Every 10 years. The Constitution says it occurs every 10 years after the census. But and I would suggest that this is kind of a bedrock issue. That's the reason why we have districts where the only people we have to talk to are the people that decide the nominating contests, you know, because the districts are drawn in such a way to like Democrats or Republicans. Now, the Senate's a little bit different because the districts are so large. You can have more modification. But the 3rd Congressional District, when I was a kid, up until probably the 80s, the 3rd Congressional District, this was up until 91, was basically the city of Richmond, Chesterfield County, Henrico County, and Hanover County. That was the 3rd Congressional District. In the 91 redistricting, the Constitution or Voting Rights Act case from the Supreme Court as interpreted by the first Bush Justice Department required us to create a minority-majority district. And so the 3rd Congressional District is now a minority-majority district, and it picks up basically African-American precincts from the city of Richmond to the city of Norfolk. It's not intended to elect a Democrat or a Republican, but it's intended to elect an African-American. And that's what it does. And there are legislative districts like that, too, not just congressional districts. For a number of years, I've kind of waved the flag and I beat at windmills that are still standing and said, you know, the way to bring about reasonableness to our government is to ensure that the districts are competitive, they're compact and contiguous, they represent communities of interest, the old rules, you know, and I'd suggest that the way to do that is to take redistricting out of the legislative process. As long as David and I, not that we would do anything with it, but of course we would, but as long as us guys and those of us who are elected to office do the redistricting, there's a built-in conflict of interest. You know, we're going to try to protect our turf, and we're going to try to protect our party's turf. But what they've done in an increasing number of states, you know, I think 16 or 17 states, including places as bizarre as Mississippi and New Jersey. Not that there's anything bizarre about those states, but what I'm suggesting, if they can figure it out, why can't we? We're Virginians, you know? They have nonpartisan panels that do the redistricting there. Now, if those, and Iowa, listen to this, Iowa's constitution even says that the districts have to be drawn in such a way that you don't consider where any candidate lives, you don't consider where any incumbent lives, you don't consider past political performance. The only thing you consider is population. Gosh. And they have competitive races. You know, two-party competition is not a bad thing. You know, there's no rule that says just because I'm elected or David's elected or anybody else is elected that we're entitled to a seat for life. Two-party competition is a good thing. And I would suggest that if we had real two-party competition in every district in Virginia, we would end up with a more problem-solving focused legislature, and we wouldn't be in this Medicaid impasse right now. But, you know, and that is a long spiel to tell you that's exactly what happened with the 3rd Congressional District and with other districts. I mean, you look at the way the districts are drawn. The one you're drawn in, sitting in right now, is a skinny district from the North Carolina border up to Fauquier County. I mean, to the Washington suburbs, from Danville to the Washington suburbs. What sense does that make? It makes no sense whatsoever. It's just drawn to elect the person, re-elect the person who's in the seat. Bottom line.
Senator Deeds is a little too modest here. He's actually been leading the fight on nonpartisan redistricting and even got a bill out of the Senate a couple years ago to do that. It has died in the House generally because the folks who control the House do not like to take redistricting out of the control of the politicians. And you can see it. I mean, think about this for a minute. In the last election, Terry McAuliffe got, 52% of the vote?
Something like that.
And then the lieutenant governor got 51% of the vote, and the attorney general got 50% plus whatever it was. And so that's 50-50-50, right? Okay, so can anyone tell me the percentage of Democrats in the House of Delegates? 32%. Now, how does that compute? Virginia is it's a 50-50 state. And yet, the way the lines are drawn, the Democrats are kept out. And what they do in the Republicans in the last redistricting is they shoved as many Democratic votes as they could into certain districts. And so there are a lot of districts that have Democratic performance rates in 65%, 70%. So those Democrats always get elected. And what they then did was they made a lot of seats very safe for Republicans. And what is happening as a result of this is what I talked about earlier, and that is that certain Republicans are afraid that their far right flank will outflank them. And because the elections are all often determined in primaries then, you tend to get extremes coming to a legislative process. Extremes have a hard time talking to each other. That's a lot of what's happening in Washington. It's starting to happen more in Virginia. It's worse now than when I first got down there. So, until we deal with this redistricting problem, we're going to have some very challenging issues with our body politic.
Just a couple of points to follow up on that. I don't think there's anything more fundamental. It's not sexy. It's not something that sells. It's not something you can, go on the stump and sell and get votes talking about because people don't want to hear about it. They want to hear about what you're going to do for them. They don't want to hear about redistricting reform. That could fundamentally change government to make it more responsive to people. But just last year, two of the Republicans in the House of Delegates who voted for transportation, an imperfect plan, but at least it was a plan, transportation plan, two chairmen lost in primaries. The Tea Party opponents. So there's some the concern they have is very real that they don't have to worry about the Democrats. They're only 35% of the district. They got to worry about further right wing Republicans. So and I would also I've gotten the bill out of the Senate several times. I've gotten it out when the Democrats controlled. I got it out when the Republicans controlled. I got it out when it was 2020. But let's be real. To people in the Senate, there are some that vote for it because they know it's going to die in the House. Everybody wants to protect their turf. It's very foreign to us as human beings to want to give up something. We like doing what we do, right? All of us do. But it's passed in other states, so that gives me hope that it can pass here eventually.
Next month, the Senior Statesman Program is one on this One Virginia movement led by Lee Middleditch. Would you comment? Do you think that movements like that are going to be helpful in this, getting something to change or not?
It can't hurt. You got a lot of really good people involved in that group, and I think I've already signed indicating that I'd vote for the change that's necessary to occur. I think that probably it's difficult. If more Democrats had been elected to the House of Delegates in the last election, I think you would have seen more interest because there might be some Republicans worried about giving up their control. But until Democrats have a greater number in the House of Delegates, I'm not sure there are enough Republicans in the House who are scared enough about the prospects of losing their power that they'd vote for something like this. So ironically, you know, you have to elect more Democrats to generate a more nonpartisan arrangement for redistricting. It's a strange dynamic, but I think that's probably the only way it really happens.
A comment and a question. You identified two issues at the beginning, mental health reform and expansion of Medicaid. I would suggest that there's that at some point mental health reform is going to be enhanced by an expansion of Medicaid, that there's a strong relationship between the two. My question is that I have four grandchildren who live here in the state of Virginia, and by the time that they, assuming they so choose, would want to go to UVA or William & Mary or Old Dominion, that the cost to their parents is going to be prohibitive. And so you're faced with, you think of the debt that kids are coming out of school with today, and you think about what it's going to be like in 15 years. Is this perceived within the General Assembly as any kind of an issue, and that you need to increase your what you allocate to public education at the university level?
Great, great question. I feel your pain. I have a 16-year-old, and we've been going around, you know, see how expensive it is. Even UVA is not cheap, and it keeps rising. There are only several ways that you can deal with this issue. One is you can raise the appropriation that the state puts in, and I'd support that, but I'm not sure it'd solve the problem. The second thing is you increase an endowment. That's happening at UVA, but if you take a look at some of the other universities in the Commonwealth, you got to worry about where they're going to be in 10 years because they don't have the ability to raise an endowment like that. And another way is you're going to have to look at a little different model. I mean, because at some point it'll become unsustainable. The student debt in this country is becoming a huge problem. And I don't know that you're going to just fix it by more appropriations. You know, I was talking to somebody the other day and asked the question, what is magical about 4 years? Why can't you do something in three? Why can't you do something that combines community college with universities? We are doing a little bit on that because the costs of going to community college are a lot less. So you're going to have to think about sort of hybrid models in the future, I think, if you're really going to get your arms around this without coming up with more appropriations. Now, if Steve Landis was here, he would raise, I think, quite a legitimate point. He would say, if you look at Medicaid spending, it's an increasing amount of the budget, percentage of the budget. At some point, do we start crowding out other things that we consider to be important as well, like universities? And so you got to really watch this. And I don't think it can be solved solely by more spending, even though I think more spending is part of the solution.
The first point, you know, with Medicaid and mental health connection is pretty interesting. You know, a number of years ago, the federal government, federal Congress passed legislation called for parity in health insurance coverage for mental illness and physical illness. And, of course, that didn't produce what it said. It sounded great, but there's no parity between mental health treatment and other health care. But under the Affordable Care Act, there is. And what under Medicaid expansion, people who are eligible for Medicaid expansion will actually have better coverage for mental illness than anybody else sitting in this room. And that'll mean over $200 million a year for mental illness treatment. So it's significant. You know, I agree with Dave, a whole lot of what David said about the funding of higher education. You know, and there are three ways to look for money. You either, you know, the needs at higher education are incredible. The costs continue to increase. You got to be competitive. A place like UVA has to hire faculty and staff with such talent to continue to attract the best and the brightest. So we can continue to brag about UVA being the best public university in the country. That ain't cheap. So what do you do? You know, if you're not willing to put the dollars in at the state level, if you're not willing to make higher education a bigger priority, you're just going to continue to put the cost on the backs of the students and the backs of their parents. So I think we just have to, we've gone. This began, you know, I don't like to throw stones, but I will. I don't give a daggone. It began in about 1990. We started spiraling down in our commitment to higher education. That was when Doug Wilder was governor. And frankly, when Jim Gilmore was governor, this is something he will never get credit for because the car tax gimmick that elected him was such a bad idea. He'll never. But when he was governor, we actually renewed our commitment to higher education and increased funding at the state level. But that hadn't lasted. We need to reconsider our commitment to higher education if we are truly going to continue to have, and I think we have right now, the best system of public colleges and universities in the country. If we are going to have that, it's going to take some bucks, and we're going to have to recommit from a state standpoint our funding commitment.
Because I've attended these every year, I know that David always likes to go over some of the other bills that may have successfully passed or woefully didn't. I would also like to know how many bills you actually had to look at.
Oh, God. Well, in response to the second question, I'm on the House Courts of Justice Committee. We look at more bills than any other committee in either the House or the Senate, I think. And I think I'm trying to recall how many bills actually passed this year. It was about 900 or something like that?
Yeah, I think there were 2,700 some introduced, and that was
several, a low number.
Several hundred lower than what we've had in the past, but actually what was passed was between 800 and 900, is that right?
Yeah, something like that.
I think so.
And, you know, we're on House Courts of Justice, you know, we're lawyers. I mean, we really read these things. And you'd like to think most people read these things, but a lot of bills are pretty legalistic. And so, you know, if you're not a lawyer, you can be really intimidated. But we lawyers try to look at them and pick them apart and see about the unintended consequences. In response to the first question, you know, it seems all of the hot air was being sucked out of the room by Medicaid that it's hard to remember. We passed an interesting bill that will require us to change our textbooks so that we not only talk about our textbooks being referred to as the Sea of Japan, you know, that, but also the East Sea. That was a fascinating debate and discussion. You know, originally I thought when somebody proposed this bill, I said, you got to be kidding me. We're going to start writing the textbooks on the floor of the General Assembly. But then, you know, you sort of listen to the debate and the Korean Americans and the history of it all, and you say, oh, my God, you know, this is pretty brutal stuff that the Japanese did to the Korean Americans. So that bill passed. Usually I come here with a slideshow. Maybe I need to come back with it. I mean, I have it. It's ready, but I thought we were going to have four or five people here today, so I didn't think it would be appropriate for me to show it. You know, I can't, they don't jump to my head.
Yeah, it in terms of consequence, I think it was mental health and SOL reform. I mean, I think those were the two areas. There were lots of other little bills that, I mean, there's a bill that in the area of efficiency renamed the Department of Veterans Affairs, I think, at the Department of Public Safety and Homeland Security, and reconfigured some things, but there weren't a lot of real significant bills. Most of the discussion was about Medicaid expansion. And nothing got accomplished there.
If you want to reduce the cost of education, just cut out the student loans, because they've taken advantage of that. They knew that money was there. It's the cost of going to college is four or five times of any other inflation we've had. and they just decided that, hey, that money's going to be there, and we'll tell all these kids to come, and it'll be just wonderful. And it is. They've been able to make the professors so they do very little teaching anymore. They don't, you know, it's a gravy train. And it would, it's not competitive as far as what they get out of it. When it costs $200,000 to send a kid to 4 years college, which is getting, which it is most places now, it's ridiculous. And then the poor guy gets out and he'll never pay that off. So it's a real tough problem. But, you know, the solution is there. And as far as worrying about gerrymandering, you want to do with that, just put in term limits.
Here's the problem with term limits, and we can have this discussion all day long, but my home is in Bath County. We have 4,500 people in Bath County. I've been in the General Assembly 23 years. I'm now committee chair. The only power that a little rural areas anywhere in the country have is through seniority. That's the only power at all in the legislature. And I guess the other point is, you could argue that there's a term limit. It's called an election, every 2 years, every 4 years. I'm willing to discuss that. I don't think that that's the answer for gerrymandering. I think that we need to come up with a better way. No, I hear what you're saying. Now, with student loans, you know, and Rod, you might disagree with me, but the early 80s, when they privatized the loan market, when I was in college, you know, I had NDSL, National Student Defense Loans, or whatever, NSDL loans, at very low interest rate, and I got them paid off a few years after I got out of college, after I got out of law school, and that was all right, but they basically privatized the student loan market, and the cost of the loans have gone up incredibly. The amount of debt has gone up. It's, you know, I agree. It's unconscionable. And kids, I mean, last year, a member of the Supreme Court of Virginia called me about a student who finished UVA Law School. She called me because this student had volunteered on my campaign for attorney general back in 2005, and he'd used me as a reference. And she told me that he'd gone to 4 years at William & Mary, 3 years of law school, and he had some ridiculous amount, $2,500 to $3,000 a month in student loans. You know, how you allow that, something like that, to happen? There's no way in the world that a person who finishes, most people are going to finish school and be able to handle that kind of debt. She was calling me because she was going to hire him basically at a stipend because he couldn't find work. So the problem you identified about student loans, I think, is very real.
First, thank you very much for coming. I'm on the steering committee of the redistricting reform group that Senator Deeds and Bob referred to. It's One Virginia, spelled out, 2021.org. And if you could go to our website and sign up, we're trying to get as many names as possible. A question. I volunteer with Region 10, the local community services board. And two questions, really. First, what percent of community service board funding comes from the state? And second, what happens on July 1 if there's no budget to Region 10?
That's good. Those are good questions. I don't know what the percentage is. I can tell you that, in my view, from my looking around the state, the CSBs that succeed the most are those that have the most local funding, because the state does not provide enough money to CSBs. I don't think money's the only answer, but I think the CSBs that have the most success are in those areas where they receive the most local funding. What happens July 1 if we don't have a budget is speculation. You know, we're in uncharted water. In 2006, we didn't pass a budget until June 28th, and it wasn't signed into law until the evening of June 30th. That's the closest we've ever been. Back in 2001, It was the second year of the biennium. We didn't get a budget passed, basically because the folks that controlled the Senate, I was in the House at that time, the folks that controlled the Senate, Republicans and Governor Gilmore, disagreed about some things, and a budget amendments to the budget didn't get passed that year. Well, that was not ideal, but we could fall back on the budget that had passed in 2000. We got nothing to fall back on July 1. We're in uncharted water. So I don't know what the answer is.
Well, I can speculate a little bit. I mean, you're going to see the power of the executive in full bloom if we don't have a budget on July 1, because Terry McAuliffe is not going to let essential services not be funded, and he will dare people to file a suit saying that he's wrong. And, I think if you're worried about too much executive power in the governor, you know, you've got to be very worried about what happens July 1, because that's the only option. I mean, you're not going to let people leave the prisons, right? You're not going to. Well, maybe you are. I mean, I don't think that's the governor's not going to let that happen. He's not going to close down stuff that's essential. Now, there'll be other things that may not be considered essential, and that's when then people really going to get upset about those things closing down, everything from the so-called rest stops to everything else. But it is uncharted waters, because we never had it happen in Virginia. The governor will probably he'll go as far as he can with his executive powers and dare people to sue him, saying that he's acting unconstitutionally, and then we'll see what happens. I hope we don't get there. I don't want to be in the middle of that.
Who is checking on our veteran hospitals in Virginia to make sure they're good places and are treating the veterans in a timely manner?
We have a Department of Veteran Affairs, and I'm sure they're working with the feds to deal with that. A lot of that is complaint-driven. If you have a complaint or concern, probably should get it to one of us, and we'll get it to the appropriate person who can check into it. But that's the way it's supposed to work. We have put a lot more energy in to try to protect veterans in Virginia over the last few years, and I think that's part of some of the good work that we have done has gone largely unnoticed. But I think people have been working on a bipartisan basis to do that sort of thing.
Thanks, gentlemen, for taking the time to be here. I wondered about maybe this is sadly a little more towards the theoretical, but the notion that the Constitution is so inviolate and any changes to it, it seems like the founders had a much more dynamic idea about that document that guides so much of what we do. And could you see, especially in light of privacy, intelligence, technology, just so many things, that the Constitution could use a whole lot of brushing up? Even your 2-year term, it seems like that's such an anachronism, because the learning curve, I mean, corporate America wouldn't want to have a 2-year gig for a job that requires what you bring to it and what we get out of it. Would you like to take a swing at the thing about, oh, don't dare mess with the Constitution, it's inviolate, they knew everything, the founders, and they, you know, put down this thing that we couldn't dare tamper with. Well, Sabato has taken a couple of swings at it, too.
I mean, if the Constitution was inviolate, why would we need courts to interpret it? I mean, the point of fact, it's not inviolate. It changes based on the people who are sitting on the bench. Now, people can argue about whether people sitting on the bench are making the right decisions, but the founders recognized that the Constitution wasn't the be-all and end-all, or they wouldn't have created a judicial system to deal with interpreting it. I think that there's lots of room for change. People cite the argument that the founders would say this and founders would say that, but in point of fact, there's no way we know what they would say. They would never have anticipated what we have now, and that's not to say you throw out the principles. You don't. I mean, we value freedom of speech, freedom of religion, we value. I mean, some people say privacy may be something that's not in the Constitution, but I think that's water over the bridge now with the Griswold case and Roe v. Wade. So I think privacy is firmly established. And I think privacy, frankly, is going to, that concept of privacy is going to be important as we deal with the surveillance issues. And for those who are worried about big government, they better be worried about that. And they better be able to be armed with the argument of privacy to protect them. So, yeah, I think that there are things that that can be either changed or at least interpreted a little differently than the way some people would want it.
And I would agree with David, and I probably would. I mean, every year, and I've been on the Privileges and Elections Committee for the whole time I've been in the Senate. I was on it for a while in the House. And every year there are resolutions that come in that call on us to call for a constitutional convention to get a balanced budget passed or get something else passed. And while I might agree or disagree with a particular idea that's floated, my concern about wholesale change to the Constitution, about a constitutional convention, is that if you call it, you have absolutely no control over what it will do or who other states will send to it. And from my standpoint, that means that I much prefer to continue to use the amendment process that's in place that's resulted in, what, 26 amendments over the last 225 years, and the courts to interpret it. I think that any more than that poses a potential threat to our democracy. I mean, I think that the politics of the day, whatever they are, they might be Tea Party today, they might be radical something or another tomorrow, but whatever happens to be the politics of the day, whenever that constitutional convention is called, could dramatically alter the democratic republic that we have. I mean, maybe I'm thinking too much about it, but that would be my concern.
I am a former educator. My question is, do you think eventually we will decrease the number of SOLs and put more emphasis on application of knowledge?
Well, we did that this year. We eliminated, I think, five SOLs.
Something like that.
We eliminated in particular, it was my bill that took out two SOLs at grades 3 through 5. Took out, I guess, no, 3 tests, actually. We've eliminated some tests, and we've set up a commission to consider further changes to the SOLs. So we're well on the way right now to reforming that process, and we've reduced tests this year. Yes, ma'am. So July 1, you'll see those changes.
I know those children don't even hold pencils, they write like this. We were taught.
Yeah. The emphasis is on rote memorization, on memorization of facts so you can pass tests, instead of reading, writing, and arithmetic. And I think
prepositions at the end of sentences.
Right.
Yeah. God, all of us remember the good old days when that's when how we learned that. You know,
excuse me. As a former school board member in Albemarle County, and as a contributor and beneficiary of the Virginia retirement system, as a retiree, was there any discussion about how much of the Virginia retirement system responsibilities have been loaded onto the localities? And please assure me and any other VRS retirees here today that the VRS is viable and will continue in a healthy fashion.
VRS is viable and it will continue. I was one of only two members of the Senate that voted against the changes 2 or 3 years ago because I was concerned that you were putting too much of a burden on local government. That's exactly what happened. Hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, it's well and good to say we cut spending at the state level, but when you pass that spending on, that responsibility for spending on to the localities, that's not really responsible in my view. So I voted against it when it went through, I guess in 2011 or 2012, but it, you know, and there's always talk about it, Madison. But the ultimately, we'd end up having to to come up with more money at the state level. You know, here's the problem. The system is still underfunded. But there's a good argument to be made that you can, you know, if you look back over the last 25 years, if the General Assembly had put into the retirement system what the Board of Trustees of the retirement system themselves recommended every year, we'd be fully funded. We wouldn't have a problem.
Yeah, Madison, one year, I think you'll remember, I voted against the entire budget because it included the so-called borrowing against the retirement fund. What that meant was that we didn't put enough money into the retirement fund so we could put it into other things. People called it borrowing. It really wasn't borrowing. It just wasn't making the contribution. And once you neglect to make that contribution, the whole principle of compounding cannot work because you've not put the money in that allows it to grow, and you need it to grow in order to be viable. Now, fortunately, we've been accelerating some of our contributions over the last 2 years, and of course, we've been pushing more of the burden down on the localities in order to make the system viable. So I'm with Cree. I'm not really worried about the viability of the system. I might say one thing about the tendency of the state government to put the burden financially on localities. There are a lot of us, and you know, if Steve Landis was here, he'd say the same thing, because we've been in meetings together where we have supported the notion. I believe Steve even had the bill last year that some of us signed on to that required the state to show the local fiscal impact of any bill that we're going to pass, so that, you know, we're not putting all the burden on the localities for doing all the good things that we think ought to be done. That if we're going to pass a bill that has that impact, people ought to know it before they vote for it, because a lot of people would not vote to force the localities to pick up the tab on something.
You know, my grandmother retired from the Rockbridge school system in 1964. She was making $2,000 as a sixth grade teacher. And when she died in 1986, she was drawing about $200 a month from her VRS. I'll always remember the relationship between the retiree and VRS, the public employee, is sacred. The state has to fulfill its obligation to make that retirement system whole. And the retirement system has to remain attractive so you can attract the best people to the state system, to the state employment.
Thank you, gentlemen, for being here, and particularly for the work that you do all year long for all of us. Both of you know that I have an interest here locally in judgeships, and I'm wondering what's happening to the vacant judgeships, and there are many throughout the state, but particularly here in town with the retirement of Judge Hochschire.
It's all caught up in the budget. I mean, there are candidates. There's a local candidate that's supported by the bar. There are a couple other candidates for that circuit court judgeship. And I think probably under any scenario, that judgeship gets funded. I don't see a scenario that it doesn't. But then it comes down to horse trading and politics. We also have two judgeships at the juvenile court level that are justified by the numbers that the Supreme Court put forth after a study. And, we'd like to see those funded, too, because we have a real backlog in our juvenile courts and our general district courts. But it's all a budgetary issue, and we're not going to be appointing people until we have a budget. At least that's what I don't see any.
David's absolutely correct. We had we've spent the last couple of years doing a study by a group, a national group outside of Virginia, about what was the appropriate number of judges in throughout Virginia and our various circuits. And we got legislation passed this year that uses the numbers from that study. That doesn't mean all those judgeships are going to get funded, but we can't even get around to the horse trading that's normally involved in picking judges until we know which judges are funded, and that's going to take a budget. So my guess is, my guess is, if history is any guide, that we reach budget agreement about June 30, somewhere about 10 o'clock at night. About 10:30, 11 o'clock, we're stumbling around in some dark room, cutting through the smoke, trying to decide who the judges are, and then about 11:45, the governor signs the bill.
But the judgeships actually are still go through an appointment process.
They'll
and
go through
the
appointment.
House.
They have to go through.
That takes place in both the House and the Senate. And I'm with David. I support the bar candidates. For the, generally, in my experience is that lawyers who serve, who work with the people that are the candidates, generally have a better idea about who has got the right temperament and the right qualifications to be on the bench. And usually, I'll support bar endorsed candidates. Not all every time, but usually I do.
See, right now we our regular session adjourned. We are now in a special session for the explicit purpose of dealing with a budget and appointing judges. Those are the two purposes. We can't do anything else. Otherwise, everybody would be putting all these bills in and we'd have to be dealing with those. So we can only deal with those two things.
Gentlemen, thank you so much, like Jeff said, for your hard work and good service to we citizens of Virginia. Thank you for being here. And let's thank Senator Deeds and Delegate Toscano once again.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.